Hi, this is Scott. I really appreciate our sponsors because they make the show possible. Today's show is sponsored by Telerik. Create compelling app experiences across any screen with the Telerik platform. Telerik's end-to-end platform uniquely combines industry-leading UI tools with cloud services to simplify the entire app development cycle. Telerik offers everything .NET developers need to build quality apps faster. Try it free at telerik.com/platform. That's telerik.com/platform.
From HanselMinutes.com, it's Hansel Minutes, a weekly discussion with web developer and technologist Scott Hanselman. This is Lawrence Ryan announcing show number 455. In this episode, Scott talks with Chandra Clark about the rise of citizen science.
Hi, this is Scott Hanselman, and this is another episode of Hansel Minutes. And on the phone, I've got Chandra Clark from Canada. How are you?
I'm doing well. How about yourself?
I am thrilled, and I'm thrilled to be talking to you. You have been involved in several Canadian space advocacy groups. You've got a master's in science and space studies. You were featured in a book called Woman in Space, and you are a citizen scientist, aren't you?
I am indeed, yes. I'm fairly well-rounded in that respect, and I like to get my hands dirty with real stuff whenever I can.
Yeah, absolutely. What does that mean, citizen scientist? Does that imply that science isn't something that the average Joe or Jane can get involved in?
For the last maybe 100 years or so, actually, that hasn't been the case. It's been the case that there's been a real professionalization of science, and people haven't really felt like it's something that they could do without, several degrees, without specialized training and so forth. But actually, before we had the professionalization, all kinds of people were doing science. Just anybody who had the time or the money or the interest and just went out and explored the natural world. So to a certain extent, citizen science is a return to something we were doing once before.
So it's a reclaiming of something that we were maybe not allowed to do.
Yes, that's right. So citizen science is something where you can get involved in a project and actually do real science. You might be collecting data. You might be processing data. You might be doing some review of some information for a group. But it's something where you can actually get involved. And it's a little bit different than some of the other things you might think of with public participation in science, where they call for study subjects, for example. So with citizen science, you're not the study subject. You're actually the researcher. So there's no worry about, being a guinea pig or a lab rat in this case.
So are we the public acting as kind of a mechanical Turk? Is this rote work that we're doing?
In some cases is. It depends on the project. There's a wide range of projects that you can get involved with. I've got them classified on my website, starting with the lowest level where you can just, open up your wallet and donate to a project and make sure something gets funded. So, for example, something like that would be at experiment.com, where you can actually fund a study, a direct funding of a study, to make sure something gets researched. Another one would be monarchwatch.org. And with that, when you actually fund the conservation of monarch butterflies. So that's the first level. And then you can get into the second level stuff. And that's a set and forget type thing. And with that, what you can do is you can download a client onto your computer or even your Android phone called Boink, B-O-I-N-C. And that's out of Berkeley. And with this one, you can have your computer do all kinds of processing of data. So, for example, there's one fight malaria at home, and with that one, you're processing data about disease vectors and cures and drugs and so forth. Some of your listeners might actually be familiar with SETI at home. Exact same thing. Distributed computing is the concept behind that. And then we get into the more hands-on stuff. And that's what I like to, that's when you start actually getting involved with it. And so there are web applications for this. One of the big players in this space is called Zooniverse. And it's zooniverse.org. And with that one, that's where you start into getting, processing this stuff yourself. So one of the projects on there is Solar Storm Watch. And with that one, you get to look at images of the sun. Unfortunately, you don't need any special glasses or anything like that. And you help them identify solar flares and sunspots and storms. And by identifying that, you give them the data they need to be able to find out if there are patterns to solar flares, if there are patterns to the solar weather. And then you help them be able to determine if there's any way we can predict this sort of thing. And there are a number of different programs on there like that. Another really good one on there is called Whale FM. And with that one, what you can do is listen to whale song and see if you can identify the different patterns in the songs and see if you can pick out which pod that song might belong to. With different families of whales have different songs. So that's to get back to your question a little bit, that's where you get into some of the rote processing of it. And then actually you can get into even deeper and more involved projects from there.
So you gave the example of looking for, was it pulsars?
Yes. Yep. Pulsars is another one. Yep.
So how am I qualified to do that? I mean, you have a master's in space studies. I went to a community college. I feel like I would mess up their experiment. Like, I'd like to be involved, but I'd hate to be the one that missed it or clicked on the wrong star.
Absolutely. That's a fear for everybody who first gets into this. So there are two aspects to this. One is that they have really, really good training. They provide you with video training. They provide you with tutorials. They walk you through everything. They explain the science to it so that you know why it is you're looking for this. They do explain it in layman's terms so that you're not sitting there trying to figure out, you know, $20 words or, you know, find out what it is they're talking about. So that's the first part of it. The second part of it is that they have all of these different things broken down into really, really simple tasks. So, for example, with one called with the whale one, for example, you're just listening to the sound, and you're not trying to, you know, retune the sound or calibrate the sound, or you're just listening at that point. So they've got it all broken out. But the really important part, and this is the third part, is that you are not the only person who's going to be looking at that particular data. So, you know, someone might see that particular clip from Whale FM or hear it, rather, four or five times. So your data will be checked against the next guy's, which will be checked against the next guy's, will be checked against the next guy's. So even if you happen to screw up one, or maybe even you screw up 20 in a row before you finally get it, you know, it all gets cleaned up as more and more people look at the same data. So you're not going to cause us to suddenly launch something that shouldn't be launched or anything like that. It's all good.
So does this mean that this is something that I could get, you know, kids involved in? I wouldn't have to worry about my 9-year-old messing up some important space exploration project?
You can absolutely get your kids involved. I have my own children involved, they just love this kind of stuff. There are even, if you really want to get your kids hooked on this stuff, gamified versions of this kind of thing. So I've got on my blog, there's a whole long list called The Ultimate Guide to Citizen Science Games. But on there, so for example, there's one called Click to Cure. And it's an iPad game, and you're running a little spaceship through space. And every time you run through a particular part of the game, your spaceship, you're helping to process data on cancerous tumors, and simply by playing the game. And so there's all kinds of ones like that. There's also another one called Eterna, and that's Eterna. And with that one, it's a beautiful, beautiful puzzle game where you have a string of RNA, and you're supposed to try and fold it according to the rules that they give you. Gorgeous game to look at, fun game to play, somewhat addictive. And with that one, you're helping to find the ways that the ways that RNA, our ribonucleic acid, can bend, and that'll help us with finding drugs, good drug targets, and good drug candidates for helping cure diseases. So your kids can definitely get into it.
And is this may be a foolish question, but hopefully in citizen science there are no foolish questions. Is this really helping a scientist? I mean, some of these are so polished, like, you know, the cell slider and Click to Cure, that it almost doesn't feel like I could be doing something useful. Like, it's just a really polished PR game. Am I really providing data to these folks?
You absolutely are. If you want to, let's take it up a notch. Let's go to some of the stuff where you're actually out collecting data. So for Project NOAA, they want you to take your cell phone out, and they want you to take images of the flowers and the insects and the birds and stuff like that in your area and upload them mm-hmm. to the website. So with that, what you're doing is you're helping scientists understand what animal and bird populations are flourishing and where. A good example of how that has actually changed scientific data. The camel cricket in the United States. They recently put out a call for everybody to see if they could find camel crickets in their basements. And as it turned out, there were more species than what we realized, and that they had spread further than what anybody knew. And this was simply by getting everybody to go out and have a look. So they were actually collecting data for scientists, rather than just processing it and genuinely contributing to, the data that, that needed to be had.
And Project NOAA at projectnoaa.org is extremely polished. Mm-hmm. You might think you're on Instagram. It's that polished.
Yes, it's a really gorgeous thing to look at. And the neat thing about it too is that you can almost get lost in looking what everybody else has posted. You might even find stuff that you didn't realize was in your own neck of the woods. This is really beautiful.
So it seems
stuff
like
there.
I could take my kids out into our local open spaces and have them really, and once they see what's going on in Project NOAA, hopefully that'll inspire them to, you know, take well-framed, clean photography and maybe even identify some of these flowers and organisms.
Absolutely. Yeah. And they can take a field guide out with them. I believe also Project NOAA has some capacity for helping you to identify stuff when you're out in the field. And even if you don't know what it is, once you upload it, the internet is so big and so huge, there's going to be an expert on something somewhere. So even if you don't know what it is you're looking at, somebody will be able to help you figure it out.
It's almost overwhelming, though. There's so many of these different projects. I mean, if I were homeschooling my kids, we could spend the whole year just trying a different project every week, and we'd still have hundreds of projects.
Yes, there are a huge number. So you would have the chance to, I happen to homeschool my children. So we do use this as part of our curriculum, and we've had a good time going through some of these things, and each one of them touches on something different within our curriculum. And the nice thing is, because I've got an age range for my kids, I've got 1 2-year-old and I've got a 10-year-old and then two in between. You can tailor it and, you know, the 2-year-old can look at the pictures and go, oh, wow, that's kind of cool. Whereas the 10-year-old can start reading the scientific background of it. And then I'll send him off to go look up some stuff on Wikipedia. And then the 8-year-old can actually do some of the clicking on the, images. And then the 5-year-old can do something else. So you can spend a lot of time, really digging into all facets of it. And then the kids feel really neat because they're actually doing something that's not just, you know, replicating the volcano project for the science fair kind of thing. It's not been done before. They're actually doing something new for somebody.
Mm-hmm. And you've got a Kindle book, a short book called Be the Change, Saving the World with Citizen Science. Would this be a good place for me to start
figuring out
how I'm going to get involved?
Yeah, absolutely. I made all the links in there clickable so that you can investigate some of these projects. I've divided them up in the same way that I've kind of talked about here on the podcast in terms of, you know, how you can get started, how you can, you know, your level of your commitment, what it is you need to do, how deep you want to go. And you can start by, you know, finding a couple that you really like and donating, or you can dive right in. I tell you that for the homeschoolers, there's one that is really cool. It's called Shark Finder. And you get sent a vial of material sediment from the ocean floor, and you pick through it to look for skate and ray and shark fossils. And so you can actually do real-time paleontology at your kitchen table. We did a similar one last year, my kids and I, called Mastodon Matrix. Unfortunately, that one's run out of funding for the time being. But we were sent a huge bag of dirt, actually, from a mastodon excavation site. So we had the microscope out, we had the tweezers out, we had the magnifying glass. They sent us a little data sheet where you could figure out what it is you were looking at. We found something that we thought actually might be a mastodon hair, so they were very excited about that. Definitely a lot of shell fragments. With that one, what we were doing was helping them figure out what the world was like, you know, 10,000-11,000 years ago when mastodons were roaming about in New Jersey. So, it gave them a whole new perspective on what it was like to do real science.
Well, it definitely gets them engaged in the physicality of it. A lot of these things are very abstract. My kids are just now 7 and 9. And, you know, a million years ago is the mid-80s as far as they're concerned. So when they get to physically touch something, it definitely connects them to science in a way that it didn't before.
Yeah. It's one thing to have them do stuff on their iPad or they're on the computer. It's quite another to get them to actually get out in nature and sunshine and looking for this kind of stuff. So it's a good way to give your kids a well-rounded experience of the world.
When you found these things in the dirt, are you expected to send that back to the scientists? If you found something amazing in that dirt, I assume that it's your responsibility to send it back.
Absolutely, yeah. So what we did with that project is we sorted everything into a little Ziploc baggies. So we had a bag for plant material, a bag for shell fragments, some for stone bits. We even found an algae spore, so we gave that its own little Ziploc bag. And then we packed up all the stuff, even all the stuff that didn't look like it was important, and shipped all that back so that the scientists will be able to take all of the little specimens out and then put the rest of the dirt back, and presumably maybe even have it looked at again to see what other stuff we've missed. Because, I mean, inevitably when you've got little kids around, you're not going to catch it all. There's only so much patience some of the little ones have.
I want to say a metaphor, but just the idea of like, while some people are getting Netflix, other people are getting dirt that they can sort through. You know what I mean? There's a metaphor on what we're doing, like, as Western culture right now. Like, why aren't we doing things like this more at a larger scale? You know, for every one bag of dirt filled with mastodon hairs, there's probably 10,000 DVDs being sent out with episodes of, Nickelodeon shows.
Yeah, sir. But the neat thing about living in this age, though, is that something like the Mastodon Matrix is possible. One of the reasons why citizen science is becoming a big thing now, and wasn't so much when I first started looking at this about 10 years ago, is that the internet has enabled so much of this kind of thing. It's allowed for a site like Project NOAA to be put together fairly cheaply, fairly quickly. The templates and stuff like that, you can get to set up a website to make it look really gorgeous. All of that kind of stuff is orders of magnitude cheaper than it was 10 years ago. And it's even the case that more and more people are interested in this kind of thing because we're so connected these days, and we're starting to realize, hey, what happens here in the United States affects the kids over in China, and it affects the people in Japan. It's even the case that when we had that massive tsunami there in Japan a few years ago, a citizen science project came out of that because someone said, hey, this is something I want to be able to do something about, and I don't want to just send over money. So this fellow got together with some of his other programmers and friends and hardware specialists, and they put together radiation sensors that they strapped to everybody's car in Japan. It was called, I believe, SafeCast. Wow. Yeah. And so they now have this roving network of radiation sensors right within the area that Fukushima was, where Fukushima is having problems still to this day. And, they've got this network so people can get real-time data. They can get information that they don't have to depend on their government for, which is another big thing. They were able to do something just because the tools are there and so cheap. And if anybody's got a little bit of initiative, they can go and do something.
That is such a, there's so many buzzwords that plug into that as far as like big data and the Internet of Things. You know, if these kinds of sensors were already in our iPhones or in our cars and the privacy concerns could be allayed, one could ask the world questions, you know, like, give me a heat map of radiation in this area, or, you know, whether it be the example you gave of radiation. You know, of course, we're doing things like that with traffic now. Weather data at both a micro and a macro level could be explored.
We're starting to get into that a little bit with all the mobile phones and so forth, even with the basic sensors they do have. I'll give you two examples. One is called the Loss of the Night. And with that one, you take it outside, you have a look and see what stars you can see in your local area, and compare that to what you should be able to see on the screen. And that one gives them an idea of what light pollution is like in various spots in North America and all around the rest of the world. Another one, it's kind of like Foursquare for junk and litter. It's called Marine Debris Finder. And with that one in, I believe this one's set in California mainly, but I'm sure it'll expand. But people, when they see junk and trash near waterways, they can go on this app and they can click what they see and, you know, check in. And that will give the people who look after these waterways a good indication of where they need to go, instead of just going to a waterway that doesn't happen to have anything in it and waste the time and money to go out there. They can go to where there's a problem and go clean it up and spend a lot less time and money doing so. All kinds of applications with that sort of thing, just with mobile apps, for sure.
do you think that this is hitting or is even close to hitting mainstream? Because I feel like, you know, for every cool project like the one you just described, there are a million geocachers out there that are just leaving tchotchke in boxes and then looking for tchotchke in boxes. Like, they're not actually accomplishing anything.
We're coming up to, I think, more public awareness of the citizen science movement. In the last 2 years, I have seen more mainstream coverage of citizen science things than I have in the previous 8 years. And I think there is real scope for tapping into the geocachers, for tapping into, Star Trek fans, just as an example. I mean, you have all these people who spend so much time and so much money going to Star Trek conventions and learning how to speak Klingon and, you know, that's a lot of fun. And I understand why people do it. It's a way to get social. It's a way to meet, you know, like-minded people. And, you know, we don't always have to be serious all the time. But there is obviously a huge untapped reservoir of creative energy. Clay Shirky calls it cognitive surplus. And we have all this brain power and far more spare time than we're willing to admit. And even if we can just start tapping into a small percentage of that, all kinds of things could be done and we can make real significant progress.
That's a really great way to put it. I mean, we do, you know, as much as there are many people are struggling and there are difficulties and there are big problems in the world, at the same time, there are people. Basically, anyone listening to this podcast and anyone who has a mobile phone that have more time on their hands than perhaps that they realize, and that can be put to extremely good use with just a little bit of focus.
Yep, absolutely. And one of the things too, I just read a book called The Second Machine Age. I forget the author's name, but they talk about how technology progresses and movements progress, you know, slowly, incrementally to start with. And then all of a sudden they hit this critical mass and they're doing all kinds of things. And it's kind of like, you know, the old story about, someone putting a penny on a chessboard and then they double it the next day and then they double it the next day and, you know, 4 pennies, 8 pennies, 16 pennies. And it seems like such a small amount. But then by the time you start doubling that again and again and again, by the time you get down to the end of the chessboard, you've got thousands and thousands of dollars on the board, and it's not until you hit that critical point in the doubling that suddenly starts to explode. And we're coming to that point, I think, now, the famous tipping point where we're going to start to see some huge progress in a lot of different fronts.
Implying that the singularity is around, and of course then Skynet are just around the corner.
Yep, they may well be.
The Second Machine Age is Eric Brynjolfsson and Andrew McAfee, and it happens actually just to be the number one book in business development on Amazon right now.
There
so definitely
you go.
People should check that out. One of the other things that I wanted to take a look at was you write a number of articles for Popular Science, and recently wrote one about an organization called the Open Space Agency. And I wanted to ask someone who knew about space and understood, you know, kind of the larger system that you understand. Is it becoming cheaper to, and as such feasible to get into space? It seems like we got to Mars a lot cheaper than we got to the moon.
Yeah. I mean, obviously the big projects where we're launching probes and launching rockets and so forth, those are still pretty expensive. It still costs in the order of, you know, $10,000 a pound to get something into space. That mm-hmm. said, we have a lot more people applying their brains to it. We have now India's trying to send things up. China is trying to send things up. It's not just down to the Americans and the Russians. And also because certain components of space exploration, like the sensors, like the hardware, like the information about how to build this kind of thing, those things are becoming cheaper and far more widely available. So you're going to see a lot more attempts to do this by private citizens. This in itself might cause some problems if we're all trying to launch something at the same time. We might have a few traffic issues, but you know, we're getting to the point where yes, it's becoming cheaper to do it, and I think it's not going to be the sole provenance of very well funded governments.
And one of the examples that you gave in your article was that bringing the price of entry to exploring space as an amateur astronomer is potentially coming down by an order of magnitude or a few orders of magnitude. People putting together fairly reasonable devices for doing observations in space with mobile phones and Raspberry Pis.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. One of the things that Open Space Agency, one of their first projects is to build a astronomy quality telescope and then open source the plans so that, you know, if anybody, you know, obviously back in the day when somebody wanted to go and build a telescope, even in Kepler's time or Galileo's time, they would have to go to a specific, you know, specialist and to someone to grind the lenses and someone to do this and someone to do that. These days, with the advent of things like 3D printing and where you can just send away for quality lenses from a supply shop and this, that, and the other, anybody with, you know, the slightest bit of tinkering ability should be able to put something together that, that works pretty well. And, you know, even if they don't get it right the first time, there's communities building up around these things where they can say, hey, it does this, or what have I done wrong, or why is it showing everything the wrong way up, or whatever, and they'll be able to get some help with that kind of thing, just like with any other community these days.
Yeah, I've said in previous shows that I feel like we are abstracting on the shoulders of giants. You know, like people don't even realize how much had to happen in the world and in science for there to be a 41 megapixel CCD on a consumer grade camera.
Absolutely.
And now the idea that someone could plug those things in together with an Arduino and now I have, you know, a prosumer quality device that I can look at space with.
Absolutely.
It's unbelievable.
Yeah. One of the things I like to do when I tear down a computer or go to put some new component in or whatever is, you know, I take a second and I look at everything that in there and you think about all the knowledge that had to go before you to put that together, metallurgy and plastics and electronics and physics and everything that had to go together into something, you know, even if you just look inside your smartphone, and that's something that everybody has in their pockets, even increasingly in third world countries, these are rapidly being adopted. We have more power in the palm of our hands than what actually took us to the moon back in the 1960s. So it's just incredible how this has changed in the last few years.
Which brings me again back to my point of why we're not in the moon right now. It really comes down less to processing power and more to the physicality of moving a pound of anything or a kilo of anything out of orbit.
Yes, yes. And it also comes down to political will. I think one of the reasons why we went into space in the first place is because of the Cold War. Possibly if the Russians hadn't chucked Sputnik up there and scared everybody to bits, we might not be as far ahead on that than, we are now. And we might have actually been there earlier than what would have been otherwise had there not been a Cold War. Hard to say. You could write all kinds of cool alternative history stories about that. But, that's the way it is.
Do you find it more amazing that we made it there with the technology of the time or more amazing that we made it back?
Definitely that we made it back. The fact that we were able to put so many people up there that, it became commonplace. And it's even the case that we put so many shuttles up that, people would say, oh, yeah, okay, the shuttle launched. Okay, big deal. It became such a non-news event. Unfortunately, until we had a couple of tragedies on that score. It's good that we got to the point where it was a standard thing, but it's also sad that we lost kind of the magic and the awe and the wonder of that era. I really wish we did have that because, we've not had a moon landing in 40 plus years now. I wish we had more of that. It gives people a bigger sense of themselves, a bigger picture.
What can my listeners do? What can I do as more of a software person in the context of citizen science, perhaps maybe an open source citizen science?
Absolutely. There's a couple of things you can do. First of all, a lot of these projects are looking for people to donate time and programming experience. And a lot of these things are university funded, so they're always looking for help that way. If you're interested in starting something on your own, there is an open source framework for this called PyBossa, and you can find that at PyBossa.com. So there's a framework for doing crowdsourcing for citizen science for any number of things. And you can write your own program. You can start collecting data. You can get people involved. So that's a good way for anybody with some programming skill to really get into it, for sure.
So it looks like PyBossa is, like you say, it's a platform for one to crowdsource. So if I know a scientist or I know someone who wants to do science, they can use Pibasa to crowdsource things. And if I know about software, I can get involved with a project like this, make some pull requests and maybe make tools that they don't already have.
Yep, exactly. They're also using it, if you scroll down a bit on that site, it talks a little bit about civic hacking. That's another mm-hmm. application for this where we're trying to improve our cities. A really generic example of how that could be used is like a pothole reporter. Put together something for your local municipality to have them be able to report in on potholes in the area and have your local municipality spend less time, you know, searching for the things and more time finding out which ones are the priority and which ones are really getting under people's axles and bugging them. You know, there's all kinds of stuff like that. It's also more and more people are using this kind of thing for activism. I'm sure a lot of your listeners are familiar with the movie Erin Brockovich or have at least heard about it. Imagine if the kind of tools that we now have available for doing water sampling, for doing air testing, for doing any of that kind of thing were available to an activist like Erin Brockovich, how much we could push back when things like spills and air pollution and dumping happen. You don't have to rely on a testing agency where you might doubt whether they're actually on your side or providing you with the real data. You could go get it yourself. All kinds of applications available for that kind of stuff.
At your website, citizensciencecenter.com, on the right-hand side, I really like the section, how can I get involved? Because you've broken it down into levels.
Mm-hmm.
And it's basically, you know, this is my words, you know, it's levels of how much do I want to get off my butt? You know, level one, donate. You know, level two, install this, set it and forget it. And then all the way up to levels 5 and 6, where I actually have to leave the house.
Yeah.
I really like your 6 levels of citizen science.
Thank you. It's one of the reasons, I mean, because there are so many projects and more coming out pretty much every day, it's hard for anybody to know where to start. And it can seem very overwhelming. So I wanted to break it down in a way that people could, you know, dip their toes in a little bit, maybe play with it a little bit, and try and go from there. And then, you know, you can work your way up. And one of the questions that does come up too, when people are looking for this is, well, okay, fine, but what's in it for me apart from, you know, being able to tackle some of the problems that are going to be problems for my kids and my grandkids? So if you're looking for that little extra motivation, some of these projects, they have leaderboards and scoreboards, just like you would with any of the games that you play, Farmville and all that kind of good stuff on Facebook. They have leaderboards and scorekeeping that way. Some of the papers that are produced do actually list all the participants, some of the smaller projects. Obviously, some of the bigger projects where they have hundreds of thousands of people, that would be somewhat impractical, but they do get credit on the website. For some of the astronomy-based ones, you might even get naming rights if you happen to discover something like an extra solar planet or a pulsar or a galaxy. You may be able to see your name in lights quite literally. So get out there and give it a go.
That is very, very cool. Well, I would encourage everyone to check out citizensciencecenter.com and all of the really great resources that are up there. You've got books, your book, and others that people can take a look at. You can subscribe for free and get involved in citizen science. Thanks so much for chatting with me today.
My pleasure. I hope I tweaked the interest of a lot of people out there.
This has been another episode of Hansel Minutes, and we'll see you again next week.